on January 25th at the Heights Theater. More information at theheightstheater.com.
You are listening to KPFT Houston. I'm Michael Woodson, your producer and host of Living Art. We air on Wednesday night at 7. Tune in. Won't you join us for Art Talk?
Welcome to another edition of the Progressive Forum. The Progressive Forum covers issues such as human rights, the environment, politics, and peace and justice, in addition to presenting news, commentary, and a weekly calendar of events.
Welcome to the Progressive Forum. I'm Susan Phillips, in for Wally James. We have a jam-packed hour ahead. We have in the studio with us Dr. Audrey Nath and Democratic Party member Anthony Collier here to talk about the election results and how policies affect working families across the nation and right here at home. Following that, we'll have commentary from Heather Cox Richardson. But right now, it's high time for the lowdown with Jim Hightower.
An 1887 political adage criticizing Britain's government rightly proclaimed that power tends to corrupt, and absolute power corrupts absolutely. In today's American government, though, that adage needs a crucial update. Money corrupts, and absolute money corrupts absolutely. Washington's pay-to-play game has long been used by corporate powers to buy particular government favors. But now, the money corruption game is so routine, so massive, and so flagrant that it has become the government. The likes of Big Oil, Elon Musk, Wall Street lords, and high-tech hucksters buy politicians in bulk, literally usurping the people's authority to write public policy. But what can we do about it, especially since Democratic Party officials are also full players in this plutocratic game? Well, Zoran Mamdani showed us one solution last week with his grassroots populist victory over New York's big money establishment to become the city's mayor. He ran a true people's campaign on progressive issues and values, which he was able to do because of a populist campaign funding option the city initiated years ago called small donor public financing. This alternative provides matching dollars from a public fund for candidates who rely on small donations from regular citizens rather than begging for big bucks from billionaires. In Mamdani's case, his unabashed progressivism excited long-ignored working-class voters who contributed a few dollars each. Then, the public match added up to $13 million, enough to get his message out and organize turnout. Though he was outspent 4-1, the small donor fund provided the margin to be competitive in a big race. This is Jim Hightower saying, so why not have the public financing option where you live? For guidance, go to commoncause.org.
This is the Progressive Forum on KPFT 90.1 FM. I'm Susan Phillips, in for Wally James. The most prominent Democratic candidates in November's elections came from different wings of the Democratic Party. New York City Mayor-elect Zoran Mamdani is very progressive. Virginia's Governor-elect Abigail Spanberger and New Jersey's Governor-elect Mikey Sherrill are on the more moderate side of the Democratic Party, but all of them made affordability and the cost of living the centerpiece of their campaigns. And in that same light, we're talking this evening with two progressives and energetic Houstonians who also work hard for working families. Dr. Audrey Nath is a pediatric neurologist and an HISD mom. On her website, she says you might see her chasing her kid as they bike to school in the morning. But you also might have seen her running for HISD District 7 this last election. Though her competitor won, the election was pretty close. And Audrey is still working hard for Houston through her career and her involvement with the American Epilepsy Society, the American Academy of Neurology, Healthcare for All Texas, and the Houston Progressive Caucus. Anthony Collier serves as the primary director for the Harris County Democratic Party. He recently served as public policy director at the Houston City Council, as the director of criminal justice for the National Urban League in New York City, and as the legislative director in the Texas Legislature. Audrey Nath, Anthony Collier, welcome to the Progressive Forum.
Thank you so, so much, Susan. Thank you, Blue. And hey, Anthony, thank you for coming on KPFT with us.
Thank you for having me. It's an honor and a privilege.
There's so much to discuss from the past week.
Yeah,
of course,
go ahead.
I'll say I was at the very, very bottom of the ballot as a local candidate, but there was a lot of really amazing stuff happening up at the top, as well as some really disappointing news just a few days ago. Let's see, Anthony, do you have one place in there that you'd like to start? Should we start with the good news or the bad news?
Let's start with the good news.
Let's do it. I think that, like Susan was saying, the message of freeze the rent, let's get buses that everyone can take, is concrete and really spoke to a lot of people. And you've done policy here in Houston for many years. What do you think that your constituents or people are saying and would want in Houston?
Well, I think people are tired of the norm and what's been going on. They see that it's not working. They see that, you know, Trump's economy is hurting people, is making everything more affordable, you know, from groceries to healthcare to the cost of living. His tariffs are essentially a tax on the working class, and he's doing it to fund tax cuts for his billionaire buddies, and people are fed up. And so it's always the economy. And during the Clinton administration, they had a saying, it's the economy, stupid, and it still
is. James Carville.
I remember.
Absolutely.
Yeah. You know, you talk about health care. So I know I'm jumping a little bit into some of the bad news, but you mentioned that we somehow have the money to give tax breaks to billionaires, but then suddenly don't to help our own people with cost of living and healthcare. And, you know, after 40 days of government shutdown, there was an agreement to reopen the government with passing of this budget that does not extend Affordable Care Act subsidies to working families. And so their bills could be going up anywhere from double to quadruple what they're already paying, more than their mortgages, more than their rent. But then somehow we still have money to give the billionaires subsidies. And I think people are starting to catch on.
Sending money to Argentina.
$40 billion, was it?
I don't know the numbers.
Yeah.
We had six Democrats, including Texas Representative Henry Cuellar, crossing over to vote with Republicans to end the shutdown. How do you feel about that?
I'm really disappointed, personally. I don't know what the point was then of the 40 days of pain for American people, of so many government workers not getting paid, of airports being a mess. I don't know what the point was. I don't know.
It was a betrayal of the American people. We cannot capitulate to Trump. We cannot bend the knee. The way that you stand up to a bully is to punch him in the face. If you cower to them, they're never going to stop. At some point, we have to stand up, and I'm extremely disappointed in our leadership.
I am as well. I was really disheartened to see that there were eight Democratic senators that came on to pass this, and you know, hearing some of them talked, they seemed kind of chipper and blasé about it. I wasn't thrilled about that, what they were doing. It does make me wonder, as in previous times that I've been very disappointed, oh, remember there was Joe Manchin with the minimum wage. There was Susan Collins with the Kavanaugh hearings. I feel like that they basically, it seems like some of these lawmakers are taking turns taking the hit for these very unpopular policies.
Oh, it gets them lots of attention.
It does. And then I step back and I think, my goodness, why are we all coordinating to take hits on bad policy instead of just passing good policy? So it makes me a bit disillusioned.
Absolutely. And also, stuff like this is a reminder that elections have consequences. So a lot of people, especially younger generations, felt disenfranchised and like unheard, and so they decided not to vote because of stuff like this too. They feel like, well, the Democrats are just as bad as the Republicans because they do stuff like what these eight senators just did. But I think people have to realize that if you have one party that wants to cut funding for CHIP and Medicaid and basically have starving children in the wealthiest nation in the history of the world.
Yes.
And you have another party that wants to fund those programs and wants to make sure we don't have hungry children and that everyone has health care. You have to vote for the better party. Like, if it comes down to voting to feed hungry babies and voting to let them starve, vote for the babies every time, even if you don't like the candidate. Like, fight like hell
right.
in the primary to get the person that you want elected. But if you lose, you got to vote to feed the babies.
Well, it's a matter of priorities, right? And I always go back to the same analogy, but it's like when you're on a bus teetering over the edge of a cliff, that is not the time to argue about who gets to sit up front, right? Put the most important things as priority. Get in the back with everything else and get off that cliff. Then once you're safe on a good road, good path, then you can start ironing out those differences.
Yeah. Absolutely.
I will say, I sometimes wander into kind of conservative spaces and dialogue to see what's being said. And there was something that I found to be very interesting. I saw a comment about the ACA subsidies that was like, well, if the government is paying these ACA subsidies, that's all being gobbled up by the insurance industry. I mean, that doesn't seem like a good use of money. And to that, you know what? I have some common ground with that. It's true that the current setup with a whole bunch of for-profit health insurance companies all taking tons of profit and also hiring bazillions of middlemen who exist just to make sure people don't get coverage so they can make more money. Wow, it's extremely inefficient. I actually agreed with this conservative poster that, yeah, that setup is not the best. And for that reason, Medicare for All would save us all billions of dollars.
Right.
So it's like, you know what? Maybe there's enough frustration that we can find some common ground with progressive policies forward. That's my hope for kids.
Audrey, what do you think about Trump coming out saying that he said something very similar in the sense that the insurance companies are getting the money they shouldn't get, and therefore he wants to make sure that every American gets $2,000 buy their best insurance.
Yeah, so I don't think that's going to happen.
No.
For another, one check for $2,000 would really only cover about like a month and a half of premiums for many people. So that's not a solution. You know, when he was running the first time, he said some things that were not true, but he did say in one interview, it was something like, we're going to get everybody covered. Oh, they're going to be so
mad. It's going to be beautiful. Right.
Do you remember this?
Yeah, Susan.
And so, no, that is not what happened. And of course, knowing Trump as a person, and it should have been very obvious that this was not going to happen. He had no real plan to make this happen. However, maybe this is a moment that we can reach across to the conservatives feeling pain to and say, you know what? The for-profit healthcare industry system, it doesn't really work, and we need single payer. Maybe we can make that happen in the next year or so. I don't know.
Absolutely. And the reason why Trump came out about these $2,000 payments is because he sees the writing on the wall. He saw the results of that November election, and the Republican Party is terrified. And the thing is, Dr. Nath, what you were speaking to earlier about finding common ground with conservatives, there is a hunger for populism in the U.S.
Yes.
And Trump runs on a populist message. Trump campaigns in poetry, but governs in prose. Speaks very eloquently, not eloquently, but very, he has an accurate message about the problems that this nation is facing. The problem is he's lying about how he's going to fix it. He comes in and he makes it worse. And so we're probably going to have a populist message in order to win in 28, but we have to call out the lies and the hypocrisy on their end as well.
I have a question. So, I think you all are a bit younger than I am and maybe have a bit more understanding about how young progressives are feeling frustrated. But there were some victories right?
Oh my goodness. Like yes.
Mamdani.
Huge.
We got him up and over, didn't we, right?
You know, he started at polling at, what, 1% when he was initially looking to run for mayor. And that gives me hope.
Right.
I'm 42 years old, full disclosure. That populist and progressive policies and candidates can win on the biggest stage. What do you think, Anthony?
I agree. I think, for one, he's in New York City, so we have to take that into consideration as well. But I will say that when he first started campaigning, like you said, when he was at about 1%, yeah. one of the ways he launched that campaign was going around and asking people why they voted for Trump. Because
yeah.
there was like a That's huge right. swing in New York where Trump, I want to say, picked up like 10% of a larger margin than he got last time. So
right.
clearly people were frustrated and were voting for him for
right.
a reason.
Yeah.
And when everybody, a Democrat or an independent who said they voted for Trump this time, it was all about economic policy.
Yeah.
It was all about affordability, about frustration with shrinkflation and all of the economic anxiety that people are facing. And so him coming in with that affordability message is why he won by such a landslide.
Well, and he's yeah. reaching across.
That's right.
Right. And he's not just preaching to the choir, not living in a silo.
That's right.
And that's one thing I think that Democrats really ought to fix is there aren't enough people like Buttigieg, for instance, going on Fox News.
Sure.
You need to go where the people are. I mean, dare I say, become evangelical.
Hey, you know, James Tallarico going on Joe Rogan.
Oh, yeah.
My goodness, that was powerful hearing him. You know, the question was, why are you a Democrat? And he tells the story of what it was like to grow up with a single mom. And his mom saying, look, this is the party that takes care of people. And telling it as a personal story where you can really relate to that. And Joe Rogan was really taken by that, and so was I.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm hopeful about him.
That launched his candidacy, that Joe Rogan
sure did.
Podcast sent him into the stratosphere. Even President Obama commented on that. So that was major. And and I actually texted him after that, before he announced for the Senate.
Anthony, you're on texting terms with James Tallarico. Oh, my God.
I've done some work at the Texas legislature. Because I was touched and moved by his testimony about the child in his classroom who had the behavioral problems when they moved him out. His life kind of just fell apart, and how heartbreaking that was. And, you know, the representative talking about growing up with a single mom. And so he resonates with regular, everyday people. And, I'm excited about him. As the primary director of the Harris County Democratic Party, this is not an endorsement.
Oh, right.
But I am inspired by him, and I'm looking forward to a vigorous campaign for the U.S. Senate.
Absolutely.
Well, and that was a question I asked just before the show. His use of the word, with your title, the primary director, mm-hmm. is that primary in that there is a secondary, or is it of the primaries? And the answer was the latter. You're the director of the primaries?
Correct. It's kind of over the election. So my job entails negotiating with the Republican Party about where our polling locations are going to be, hiring election judges and election workers, also voter protection. So we have a team of lawyers in case we need to file an injunction to keep the polls open, or in case we have, Lord forbid, some case of voter suppression. And so, it's all about election integrity, ensuring that every vote counts, and over the filing process, making sure our Democrats actually get on the ballot and that we get them squared away.
That's awesome. And I just want to say, yes, as a first-time candidate, this stuff was not obvious at all. So thank you for helping first-time candidates especially.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Especially dynamic and great and gifted and brilliant candidates such as yourself.
Oh, my goodness. Full disclosure, Anthony did block walk for me some, and that was incredible. But I will say, I went and knocked on over 3,000 doors and talked to people. And people just want schools that work for their kids.
That's one thing I found interesting with the Houston Progressive Caucus is that they're trying to reach people where they live, but not just homeowners, but people who are renting.
Susan, I would love to speak to this as a candidate that did just knock on 3,000 doors. I mean, there's some logistical barriers to getting to apartments. You know, many of them are gated, and you can't necessarily get in easily, whereas single-family homes on a street without a gate are logistically the easiest to to knock on the door. And if I hadn't run, I don't think that would have been quite so obvious to me. Because then I think, wait a minute, so it's only the wealthier people in single-family homes that are getting their doors knocked on, mm-hmm. Which is a problem.
And unless they live in one of those gated communities.
But... Oh, yes. I went to some of those, too. Uh-huh. You know, sometimes people would have to let me out. You know, so we would try to address that with mailers and with digital ads. You know, I think that's big now, to try to reach people where they are on their phones, if that's where they are inside of that gated apartment complex.
Do you ever feel, well, let me ask you, do you feel safe when you're knocking on doors, or do you ever feel unsafe?
Full disclosure, yeah, I'm a 42-year-old woman, and I'm about 5'2" or so. You know, there were times that on the door there would be a graphic of like a firearm and said, "Nothing in here is worth dying over." And, yeah. You know, and then I'm like, well, you know what? I'm not here to steal anything. I'm going to knock on this door. Yeah, that can be a barrier as well. Just safety, but thankfully everything went well. But yeah, there's just some logistical things about block walking that I never would have thought about if I hadn't run, and that there's disparities in who gets reached, for sure.
Right.
And then people feel like no one ever reaches out to them because no one maybe can reach out to them very easily. And then you get this vicious cycle of people feeling like they're not listened to and not a part of the process. And then they dip out of the process, which really scares me now. I see how easily that can happen.
Do we have any numbers at hand how the demographics of who turned out this year in Houston?
I don't have that information.
So anecdotally, I ran in HISD District 7, which includes some very affluent areas, including River Oaks and Tanglewood and around Galleria. Anecdotally, as we were reviewing afterwards the precincts, there was a little more turnout for my Republican opponent in some of the wealthier neighborhoods than we were expecting. Personally, my hypothesis is they may have been driven out to vote by those tax break amendments on the ballot. Yeah. And so I think that may have... All sorts of things can affect an election that you, as the bottom of the ballot candidate, have no control over. Anecdotally, that's something that I saw in my data. Mm-hmm.
This is the Progressive Forum. I'm Susan Phillips in for Wally James, 90.1 FM, and we are sitting here today talking with Dr. Audrey Naff and Anthony Collier, who is the primary director of the city of Houston.
Hearst County Democratic Party.
Yes. So anyway, we're here talking about issues related to working families. And that's where we are. So let's keep the conversation rolling.
Absolutely. I wanted to ask Anthony about something. You know, we had, 17 amendments on the ballot, statewide amendments on the ballot. And anecdotally, I spoke with people who said, oh, yes, I'm going to vote. I'll vote for the city council and in your race, I guess. But, oh, man, I need to like read about all these amendments first. That's why I haven't made it to the polls yet. Mm. Do you think that having 17 of them on there and having them worded in really roundabout ways was on purpose to make it difficult to figure out how to vote?
I wouldn't put it past them. I definitely wouldn't put it past them. I'm not sure, but as we've seen, they're willing to use all type of underhanded tactics to win elections. So they don't play by the rules.
I think so. One of the amendments, for example, I think it was number 16 or so, was that you need to be a citizen to vote. But that's already a policy. Yeah. And so I feel like things like that were on there, not because it's a meaningful piece of legislation, but because it could help bring out different parts of their base.
Right.
And I think it worked.
And also, this whole mid-year redistricting, right? See the writing on the wall. They know they're about to lose. And so they're basically trying to steal the election.
Yep.
And all of the pearl clutching about Governor Newsom and Governor Westmore fighting
50.
Back. Yeah, Prop 50
Woo!
Passed. I'm super
yeah,
excited
that's
about
right.
that. Uh-huh. Sometimes you have to fight fire with fire.
Today, the Department of Justice has just started launched a lawsuit against Gavin Newsom.
Wow.
Because of Prop 50?
Mm-hmm.
I'm guessing they didn't launch a lawsuit against Texas,
right? They said
right?
It's racial gerrymandering.
Oh, but that happened here too.
Right. It happened here first. It happened here first.
Well, can we? You're a doctor. Can we say projection?
Oh my goodness. Oh yes. Getting into psychological terms really explains so much of what's going on. Talking about personality disorders, I think explains a lot of this behavior as well.
Is there like a supervillain disorder going on?
Kind of. We talk about like dark triad personality traits.
Well, it does seem with all of the with all of the characters that Trump is pardoning.
Yes,
Santos. You know, just it doesn't even matter their political affiliation. If they're corrupt, he's letting them out.
Right.
That's
it's
right.
Almost like it really is like a Batman movie.
Mm-hmm. Yes. I was talking with my dad. He says, like, this is all worse than some banana republic. You wouldn't have dreamed of all of this. But, you know, what's interesting to me is talking about Trump and his over-the-top antics and flagrantly corrupt behavior. But I feel like what started the economic situation that we're in was someone who was much more docile. Ronald Reagan, I feel like, is what started the trajectory that we're on now, with trickle-down economics and hoarding of wealth at the top, was the beginning, and it came in a nicer package than Donald Trump.
He was more of a statesman.
Yeah, right? He wasn't this...
He wasn't embarrassing, not really,
right.
You know.
He wasn't some braggadocio reality star or whatever, right? It was a much nicer package, but I feel like that sort of... The reason we don't have an increased minimum wage, but the reason we don't have nice things started there.
The EPA, Environmental Protection Agency, started under Nixon.
Yeah, that's right. Mm-hmm. That's right.
And also, speaking of Donald Trump's presidency, you know, he... When he did the blanket pardon of January 6th insurrectionists that we talked about, one of them actually tried to kill Hakeem Jeffries. And he texted one of his buddies saying, Hakeem Jeffries is going to be speaking in New York. I'm going to kill him.
I didn't even know this.
And they flagged it to the, to the FBI, and then they came and arrested him before he could assassinate Hakeem Jeffries. These are the type of people that Donald Trump gave this blanket pardon to. I'm sure you've all seen Lion King, right?
Yes.
This is like when Scar took over the kingdom. This is what we're living in right now. We're literally living under a supervillain. And it's and he's running the kingdom with his hyenas.
That's right.
It's really like gross.
You know, I'm really struck by what you just said, because there is just so much happening every second of every day that I feel like I try to stay up to date, and there's
it's
so
hard
much
to.
You
and,
can't
and
even keep up with it all.
But...
And I think it's on purpose. That's a Steve Bannon tactic, is mm-hmm. to flood the zone with so much mm-hmm. that people just can't keep track.
Yep.
Well, but I think that these elections did show that we can start turning things around.
We can. We talked about Zohran Mamdani in New York City. There's also Seattle, the Seattle mayor, Katie Wilson, and she won by a small margin. And she's progressive over there as well. So maybe city by city, we can make this happen.
Absolutely.
I would love to see this happen in Houston.
It can happen.
It's inspiring that somebody like Mamdani can win an election.
Yeah.
And I think, to my earlier question, do you think that will inspire young people to vote, that maybe it does make a difference?
I think it did there. He got, 50,000 volunteers, largely young people that hadn't volunteered in other races. But Anthony, I'd love to hear your take on how we can make this happen in Houston.
It's going to take the right candidate, like a charismatic populist type of figure. We've seen it before, right, with President Barack Obama.
Yeah.
Of course, Mamdani is much more progressive than Obama was then. But at that time, in 2007, Obama was considered a progressive.
Sure.
It just goes to show you the progression of the party. Like, we talk about how the Republican Party has kind of spiraled into... it's just been getting worse and like, kind of like degenerate. I think the Democratic Party is headed in the other direction. And
it's hopeful, right?
At the top of the party is still held down by like some, I don't want to say spineless, but some some moderates who probably need to get out of the way. But the base of the party is a lot more progressive. The base of the party is Mondami.
Yeah.
It's Bernie Sanders. It's AOC. It's Jasmine Crockett. And I believe that that type of energy is the future of the party. And I do believe it's possible here in Houston. We just need the right candidate to turn those people up.
You were mentioning Jasmine Crockett earlier.
Mm-hmm.
Can you carry that on forward in this conversation?
Absolutely. First of all, I love, love, love Jasmine Crockett. She's a friend of mine. I actually met her when she was running for state rep. So the chairman and CEO of the National Black Law Students Association. When I was over the Southwest region, we brought her in as a speaker. And so I met her back then on the campaign trail. And I told one of my mentors, she is going to be a star. This lady is a rock star. And we've been in touch since then. So to just see her career take off the way it's taken off, I'm super proud of her. I'm her biggest fan. I think what she is, from my understanding, she's considering a run for the U.S. Senate. Mm-hmm. That's going to be interesting because I think that, just practically speaking, right, I love her. I love Tallarico. Mm-hmm. I don't know the congressman from Dallas.
Oh, Allred?
I don't know Allred as well, but I have no hard feeling towards him.
Yeah.
It seems like, and this is not the statement of the party, this is Anthony speaking in his own personal capacity. I think Crockett will probably win a primary, but I think Tallarico might have a better chance in the general.
Sure.
Just because the state of Texas, in rural Texas, there's a lot of racism, there's a lot of sexism, and I think Tallarico being a white man and a preacher would be... They would be easier for some of those to stomach him.
I think so too.
But I would hate for us to lose Jasmine Crockett in the House because she's such a staunch advocate, and she's I would hate for us to lose that platform and that leadership, and for her to kind of just be in limbo. So it would be cool to see if we win in 26, and then it's possible that maybe she runs in 2030. But at the end of the day, she should do what's best for her. She should pray on it, talk to her inner circle, and then decide what she thinks is best.
Well, another thing about Tallarico is the Christian aspect of it. There's Christianity, and then there's Christianity.
Mm-hmm.
And he speaks to the Christianity that is actually Christ-like.
Right, yeah.
Feeding the poor, the hungry, visiting the those in prison, like looking after people. Matthew, the Gospel of Matthew, which white nationalist evangelicals just don't seem to. It's like they don't.
Along those lines,
yeah.
Susan, there was a viral moment, I think, like a couple days ago, where there's a woman who tested this out. How Christ-like are these churches? And she called saying, hey, I've got a baby and I'm out of formula. Can you help me? And it was very interesting, some of these bigger mega churches that did not help her, which is not very Christ-like, like what you're talking about, like the actual values.
Mm-hmm.
And so that just went viral, and I think that was eye-opening to me.
Right.
And to your point, they love to quote Leviticus and Moses, but they never seem to quote Jesus. My politics is tailored after Matthew 25. I am a Matthew 25 Christian, a Matthew 25 political. When Jesus said, when I was hungry, did you feed me? When I was thirsty, did you give me water? When I was homeless, did you provide me with shelter? When I was sick or in prison, did you visit me? When you do it to the least of these, then you do it unto me. And yeah, that's the type of politics that I ascribe to as well. And I think that progressives have kind of conceded Christianity and faith to the right, and I think that's a mistake. I think we should take it back and we're the authentic Christians because we're the ones doing what Jesus told us to do.
Right. It does seem like people on the far right, the MAGA, has tried to own Christianity and patriotism.
Mm-hmm.
I really love seeing patriotic chants and signs at progressive rallies.
Absolutely. I agree with that. And I think this came up, running for school board, people saying, oh, but you protest things and you seem to be so negative. Why are you so negative? Do you just not like anything? And it's like, no, actually, I am so hopeful for the future that I can envision something better.
Right.
Right. You know, and it's just a different way of framing what protest is. It's hope, I think. Mm-hmm. I think protest and chants and all that and organizing shows that we think something better could happen for our country because we love this country.
Absolutely. And the Republican Party has forfeited the right to be the party of patriots after January 6th, after their leadership condoned an insurrection to overthrow this government, after they have the leader of their party with 2028 shirts and hats and making renovations to the White House. It doesn't look like he's planning to go anywhere soon. Like the formation of this nation was about no kings, about standing up to tyranny, and now they have a wannabe tyrant and a wannabe dictator at the highest level of government, and it's shameful.
We were formed on freedom of religion, freedom of speech, the opportunity for everyone to thrive is why this country was made. Mm-hmm. We've veered pretty far from that.
And if we don't get 2026 right, we might not have any more elections.
Agreed.
Like, Trump is not playing. And the Republican Party has shown that they will capitulate. We have to, hopefully we can take back the House and the Senate, but we at least have to get back the House to save democracy. And so everyone has to get out the vote. And 26.
I saw just today on social media, Beto here in Houston at UH registering people to vote and a bunch of people volunteering. Again, I have hope because this is the only way forwards.
Well, that's what you were saying was the ban in effect, the inundation, you know, the rogue hose of terrible things happening every day. It's meant to cause people to give up hope.
Yes.
And it's wonderful to see that hope doesn't die.
And I think that's a big reason that protesting is important and organizing a whole bunch of people together and, you know, commiserating, having camaraderie, reading each other's signs. So because some people, I've heard people say, oh, well, that protest isn't going to change anything. Well, the organization of everyone together and everyone then voting together can make a difference.
Absolutely.
And we are making a difference here on KPFT, hopefully. This is 90.1 FM, KPFT. I'm Susan Phillips in for Wally James. And we have a few more minutes left on Progressive Forum. We are talking with Audrey Nath and Anthony Collier. And we are just having a roundtable discussion about what the elections mean and how to go forward in the future for progressives, this being the Progressive Forum. So is there, before we leave, is there anything that either of you want to talk about that we haven't touched on?
I'd like to give a shout out to another win where there is good news, and you're right, we need to talk about it for the school board end. So my race, I did not win. However, the slate of pro public education candidates in Cy Fair, they all won and took back their school board, which is a huge deal. I know one of them, she posted on social media that Kamala Harris called her to congratulate her. And yeah, it's that big of a deal because Greg Abbott had even visited Cyprus because of fear that the MAGA school board would be taken down, and they were. Additionally, my slate mates, Maria Benzon, Michael McDonough, they won their races here in HISD. So there are good things that happen locally as well.
Yeah, I was working on the Benzon campaign. The party for the first time has endorsed HISD candidates. I wish I was working on your race because, man, I really wish I could have done more to help you.
That's
but
all
next
right.
time, next it, time we're hey. Gonna. And even if it's not this, maybe you run for something else sooner.
You had a talk. You had a healthy you had a healthy percentage.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely, and that includes a large swath of Republican territory in District 7. So, you know, we got a lot of voters out, I will say, that do not normally vote in municipal elections. That was a call that I got from my campaign manager the next day or so. Like, hey, there's like hundreds of people that would not normally vote in municipal elections. And maybe it's some combination of people you know or other parent friends or other physician friends or just friends, people that would not have normally voted. So I'm proud of that as well.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let me ask y'all this. I know you talked about if there are any lasting thoughts we had, things we wanted to touch on. What do y'all think about the prospects of the Democratic side of the 2028 presidential election? Is there anybody y'all excited about running? Anybody y'all would like to see jump in? Or what about the people that we kind of already know are going to run?
Well, we know that Gavin Newsom is going to make a run for it.
Yeah, he looks like the front runner right now, too. But a lot can change in 2 years.
Yeah. A lot can change.
It's so hard for me to even think that far because, Anthony, to your point, if we don't make some big gains in 2026, I don't even know what things will look like by then.
Right.
Personally, I know it's a long shot. I love following Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on social media, and she just explains things in such a clear way that, you know, maybe it's early for her, but I hope to see her as president at some point.
I have some thoughts on that.
Yeah.
What do you think about her primary in Schumer? Because
I'd love that too.
Because for one, it would be easier for her to win that primary than to be elected president from the House. And if she wins that primary and she's in the U.S. Senate, it would be a lot easier for her to run for president in the U.S. Senate.
Okay. Anthony, you're playing chess.
I love this. Alexander, if you're listening,
yeah,
this is what we think here in Houston.
Yep. So yeah, AOC is great. I love AOC. I like Governor Wes Moore out in Maryland. I like him a lot. He's charismatic. He's a fighter. He's a veteran. He's a handsome guy. I think, yeah, don't sleep on Governor Wes Moore. But and of course, we have Governor Shapiro. We have the governor out in Illinois.
Oh, yes, Pritzker. Uh-huh. I like him.
Uh-huh. We have Governor Whitmer, Gretchen Whitmer.
Yes, that's right.
And so, and then and Vice President Kamala Harris, it looks like she's gearing up for another run as well. And
is
so,
she?
It seems like.
Well, and here's the thing. As a woman, as a sort of feminist, right?
Yeah,
yeah, sure, I'm a feminist. But we've had two women running against Trump, and he's knocked them both down.
Mm-hmm.
What is the lesson we learn from that?
Okay.
Right? Is that we shouldn't run a woman next time? Or is it, I'd hate to have that be the message is what I'm saying, but...
Here's what I think personally, just my personal opinion. I think that Kamala Harris was coached and held back from saying the more progressive things she wanted to say. That's what I think.
Mm-hmm.
But I think she also did not put much distance between herself and some of the policies that were less popular.
That's right. That's right.
She, Vice President Harris's race, I think we have to take with a grain of salt because it was so unconventional.
That's true.
She didn't have a lot of time and a lot of leeway.
Mm-hmm.
And so since President Biden got out of the race so late, I don't know if we can have an accurate assessment of what went wrong.
Yeah, there really wasn't enough time for that.
3 months?
Now for Secretary Clinton, I think she could have won that race if that race was run a little different. Like, from my understanding, she didn't even visit Michigan, which was a key swing state barely lost by a couple thousand votes.
Oh, I didn't
and
know
so
that.
I think we assumed that she was going to win. And I think that the data showed that she was going to win by a landslide. So we kind of took our foot off the gas. But if she had aggressively campaigned, we might not even be having this discussion right now. The nation might look a lot different. So I think a woman can win.
Yeah. And so I guess what it comes down to is I personally am scared of the it's my turn kind of mentality.
That's right.
It's this person's turn, right? She was waiting in the wings and it was really her moment.
Yeah, I agree with that. That shouldn't be how we pick candidates.
Yeah. Something where it's someone's moment.
Mm-hmm.
As opposed to who's really going to win.
Yes.
I like what you said, Anthony, about AOC maybe primarying Schumer.
I love that.
Yeah, and I agree with you about the whole thing about people's turn or an anointed candidate. Look, the greatest kings crown themselves. You can't – and also it's not about an anointed candidate. The people have to decide. For example, in 2008, Hillary Clinton was the anointed candidate. She was the anointed candidate in 2016, but she was also the anointed candidate in 2008.
Goodness.
Even the Congressional Black Caucus was backing Hillary Clinton. But Obama, and it's thank God Obama didn't just say, well, it's Hillary Clinton's turn, so
that's
I'm just,
right.
No, he ran anyway. And he won, and the people chose him.
Mm-hmm.
And so, I mean, in 2024, we didn't get that opportunity. I would have loved for us to have had a real primary, a spirited primary.
Yes, I agree.
2016, we had a primary, but we can tell, like, Hillary was going to be the candidate.
Yeah.
I feel like Bernie, I honestly don't think he got a fair shake. And I think Bernie probably could have won because he would have ran on a real populist message. Yeah. And then it's almost like, you know what a Chrysler 300 is?
No.
So a Chrysler 300 is a certain type of car that's popular in like urban America. It looks like a Phantom until a Phantom pulls up. And so that's like Donald Trump looks like a populist until he has to run against a real populist. And so I think Bernie would have been a good matchup for Trump. So I'm excited about 2028 because I think we're going to get a real spirited primary and then let the best candidate win.
And spirited is a good word. In the spirit of we're all working together, hopefully whoever is running against each other as Democrats in the primaries, they're not going to cut each other down. Mm-hmm. If you start pointing out your opponent's flaws as a fellow Democrat, then that's going to stick to that person if they win.
You know, I will say, I had met James Tallarico at a small event, and he was asked about his opponent, Colin Allred.
That took a great picture, by the way.
Oh, yes, I did get a picture with him. I was fangirling and very starstruck. And he, you know, he said, you know, Colin and I, we have different approaches to things. Mm-hmm. And he didn't go low. He didn't say anything insulting. And I thought that was really cool. I think Absolutely. We can have more of that.
And it goes back to the conversation that we had earlier about feeding the babies, right? Whoever, the party has to coalesce around whoever wins. Like, if you whoever your candidate is, go out there in the primaries, try to get a job on the campaign. If not, volunteer, do everything you can to have your person win. But if they lose, we have to unite around the candidate.
That's, and we work have to together.
Win. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. It's got to be a team. And speaking of teamwork, we are running out of time.
Oh, look at that.
It's been a wonderful team effort here, this conversation. I'm so glad that you could join us.
Oh, this is so fun. Thank you for having us.
Yeah, so I'm Susan Phillips. I'm sitting in for Wally James. We've been speaking with Dr. Audrey Nath and Democratic Primary Director for the City of Houston, Anthony Collier. And it is time now for Letters from an American with Heather Cox Richardson.
November 12, 2025. It turns out Representative Eric Swalwell, a Democrat of California, and House Democrats were right to call it the Epstein shutdown for the last several weeks on social media and in interviews. As Mark Elias of Democracy Docket put it today, while it was clear what the Democrats wanted from the shutdown, lower costs for health care insurance premiums, affordability, and for Trump to stop breaking the law, it was never clear what the Republicans wanted. They seemed simply to be doing as Trump demanded. Speaker Mike Johnson, a Republican of Louisiana, kept House members from conducting any business at all. The House last voted on September 19th, gathering in Washington, D.C. again, only after the Senate on Monday passed a measure to reopen the government. The hiatus gave Johnson an excuse not to swear in Representative-elect Adelita Grijalva, a Democrat of Arizona, whose voters elected her on September 23rd. Grijalva had promised to be the 218th and final vote on a discharge petition that would force the House to vote on a measure that would require the Department of Justice to release files relating to the government investigation into sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Elias notes that he, like many of us, considered as plausible the idea that the government shutdown was a way to keep the Epstein files under wraps, but there were other plausible theories as well. Maybe Trump and his cronies wanted to gut the federal workforce. Maybe they wanted to undermine the Affordable Care Act. Maybe Trump simply wanted to run the country without the interference of Congress. Today put the Epstein files firmly in the center of the story. The House got down to business this morning after a 54-day break to work on the Senate measure to reopen the government. Democrats on the House Committee on Oversight and Government Reform immediately released three emails from a cache of more than 23,000 documents the committee received recently from the Epstein estate. The first email was one Epstein sent to his associate, Ghislaine Maxwell, on April 2, 2011. It referred to a story in which the fictional detective Sherlock Holmes solved a case by noting that a dog didn't bark at a crime scene because it knew the perpetrator. The reference has come to mean an expected action or piece of evidence whose absence proves guilt. Epstein wrote, I want you to realize that that dog that hasn't barked is Trump. A victim spent hours at my house with him. He has never once been mentioned. Police chief, etc. I'm 75% there. Maxwell replied, I have been thinking about that. The second email the Democrats released was from January 2019, from Epstein to Trump biographer Michael Wolff. In it, Epstein said of Trump, of course he knew about the girls, as he asked Ghislaine to stop. In a third email thread from December 2015, after Trump had declared his candidacy for the 2016 presidential election, Wolff told Epstein that CNN would ask Trump about his relationship with Epstein. Epstein asked what Wolff thought Trump should answer. Wolff wrote, I think you should let him hang himself. If he says he hasn't been on the plane or to the house, you can hang him in a way that potentially generates a positive benefit for you. Or, if it really looks like he could win, you could save him, generating a debt. As legal analyst Asha Rangappa noted, this exchange suggests that Epstein would have leverage over Trump if Trump tried to say he had not been at Epstein's house or on his plane. In other words, that Trump was there and Epstein had receipts. After the Democrats released these three emails, Johnson called the release another publicity stunt by the Democrats and claimed they're trying to mislead people. Committee Chair James Comer, a Republican of Kentucky, issued a statement accusing the Democrats of cherry-picking documents and politicizing information. The committee then released an additional 20,000 pages of documents received from the Epstein estate. Those were hardly better. In a 2015 email, Epstein gave tips on stories about Trump and girls to then New York Times financial reporter Landon Thomas Jr. When others asked Thomas for stories, Epstein wrote, have them ask my houseman about Donald almost walking through the door, leaving his nose print on the glass as young women were swimming in the pool, and he was so focused he walked straight into the door. In another email, Epstein offered photos of Donald and girls in bikinis in my kitchen. And Thomas urged, I'm serious, man. For the good of the nation, why not try to get some of this out there? But a story revealing this information did not appear in the New York Times before the 2016 presidential election or afterward. In one 2018 email referring to Trump's payment of hush money to adult film actress Stormy Daniels, Epstein wrote, I know how dirty Donald is. Despite how explosive these documents were, they do not appear to be the end of the story. They came from the Epstein estate, but the files from the FBI investigation into Epstein have not yet been released. Whatever is still outstanding appears to be even worse than what we have seen, as evidenced by Trump's frantic attempts to stop the discharge petition. With the House back at work, Johnson had little choice but to swear in Grijalva. The ceremony was scheduled for 4 o'clock. In the hours before that deadline, the president tried to get one of the four Republican representatives who had signed the discharge petition to remove their signature. He appeared to focus on Nancy Mace, a Republican of South Carolina, with whom he tried to connect by phone, and Lauren Boebert, a Republican of Colorado, whom he invited to meet with him in the White House Situation Room, which is equipped to prevent recording. CNN reported that Attorney General Pam Bondi, Deputy Attorney General Todd Blanche, and FBI Director Kash Patel joined Trump and Boebert at the meeting. When asked about the meeting, White House Press Secretary Carolyn Leavitt told reporters, doesn't that show the level of transparency when we are willing to sit down with members of Congress and address their concerns? For his part, Trump took to social media to call the released documents an attempt by Democrats to bring up the Jeffrey Epstein hoax to deflect from how badly they've done on the shutdown and so many other subjects. He urged any Republicans involved to be focused only on opening up our country and fixing the massive damage caused by the Democrats. Trump's efforts to get someone to take their name off the discharge petition failed. Johnson swore in Grijalva at 4 o'clock as scheduled, and she immediately signed it. Now the petition needs to ripen for 7 legislative days. Then Johnson has 2 legislative days to schedule a vote on a measure to require the Department of Justice to release the Epstein files it holds. Faith Wardwell and Meredith Lee Hill of Politico reported this evening that senior Republicans believe as many as 100 Republicans will support the bill when it comes to the floor. Many of them are facing constituents who voted for Trump in the belief that he would release the Epstein files as he promised, and who are angry that the administration appears to be covering them up in the service of rich elites. Others likely recognize that they do not want to be seen as participating in that cover-up, especially with the threat of even worse material waiting to drop. If the House passes the bill, it will go to the Senate, and if the Senate passes it, to Trump for his signature. If he vetoes it, Congress has the option to override his veto. In the past, Trump has managed to avoid accountability for his actions by using lawsuits to delay while whipping up his supporters to take his side against what he called witch hunts or hoaxes. Republican lawmakers went along in part because they didn't want to alienate his base. Now, though, a significant portion of MAGA has broken with him. His popularity is low. A new Associated Press NORC poll has his approval rating at 33%. And last week's elections showed his coalition is abandoning him. It's not clear that Republican senators will defend him, especially since his erratic behavior, like bulldozing the East Wing of the White House, appears to be increasing. As Representative Thomas Massie, a Republican of Kentucky, who backed the House discharge petition, told CNN, "This vote is going to be on your record for longer than Trump is going to be president. And what are you going to do in 2028 and 2030 when you're in a debate and they say, 'How can we trust you? You covered up for a pedophile back in 2025. As new revelations from the Epstein documents were hitting social media every few minutes, Representative Swalwell posted, "This is the beginning of the end." Tonight, the House passed the Senate's continuing resolution to fund the government, ending the longest government shutdown in U.S. history, 43 days. The vote was 222-209, with all but 2 Republicans voting in favor and all but 6 Democrats voting against it, saying they would not support a continuing resolution that did not extend the premium tax credits for health care insurance purchased on the Affordable Care Act markets. Republicans neglected to extend those credits in their budget reconciliation bill of July, the one they call the One Big Beautiful Bill Act, and without them, millions of Americans will be unable to afford health care coverage, and premiums will skyrocket for millions more. The measure funds the government through January 30, 2026, overturns the layoffs of federal employees administration officials made during the shutdown, guarantees workers' pay, and appropriates money to pay for Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program benefits through September 2026, taking them out of Trump's hands as a pressure point in January. Failing to get an extension of the health care premium tax credits into the continuing resolution, House Democrats filed a discharge petition to force the House to vote on a measure that would extend the credits for 3 years. There are only 2 ways this fight will end, Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, a Democrat of New York, told his colleagues. Either Republicans finally decide to extend the Affordable Care Act tax credits this year, or the American people will throw Republicans out of their jobs next year and end the speakership of Donald J. Trump once and for all.
Letters from an American was written and read by Heather Cox Richardson. It was produced at Soundscape Productions, Dedham, Massachusetts. Recorded with music composed by Michael Moss.
Thanks for joining us this evening on Progressive Forum. I'm Susan Phillips, in for Wally James. He will be back next week. Stay tuned. Up next, we have Jacqueline Batiste with People of Earth.
Hi, I'm Mel.
And I'm Ro.
We're from Shame on Me.
And you're listening to KPFT Houston.
KPFT Programmer Profile.
Hi there. This is Dwayne Bradley, host of the Open Journal program, Mondays at 6 p.m. It's KPFT's radio magazine of the airwaves. We have long-form conversations with interesting people from in and around the Houston area. They may be artists, they may be academics, they may be creatives, but certainly the conversations we have are not little soundbite radio or TV excerpts. These are 20-minute long conversations usually, and a song from a local artist each week as part of our Open Journal magazine package. Hope you tune in, and thanks for listening to KPFT.